Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Performing Arts podcast, part of the New Books Network. My name is Andy Boyd. Today, I'm talking with Stuart Klawans about his new book, Crooked But Never Common, The Films of Preston Sturges. Stuart, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Really happy to be here.
So I had an experience that's probably going to be familiar to a lot of Preston Sturges fans, which is I showed my spouse, the Lady Eve, a couple of weeks ago as I was preparing for the interview, and they thought it was hilarious, much more so than most other movies that came out in the 1940s. And I'm a big old Hollywood fan, but I think it's fair to say that Preston Sturges movies hold up comedically much better than most even great comedies of that era. Do you have any idea why that is?
No, Now you've asked the big question, yes.
Yes, I thought I'd start with an easy one, kind of warm you up.
Let's start with the gestalt, shall we?
Yes.
Right. Sturges is generally thought of as having written the best dialogue ever in Hollywood. And many people just concentrate on that aspect of his films. His dialogue across the board for all characters, minor, major, whatever their backgrounds, whatever their status in life, the dialogue is always amazingly funny, amazingly clever. He himself said his great talent was an ability to spritz dialogue. My proposition in my new book is that he did a lot more than that. Mm-hmm. And if you look at his work as a director, which is what he longed to be and eventually was, it's the work, his work as a director and how he directed these screenplays is equally important as the dialogue, if not more important, mm-hmm. actually. And it's a combination of this amazing, brilliant dialogue and not always obvious, but always very clever visual direction, direction of actors that makes the films hold up so brilliantly. Mm-hmm. That plus the final ingredient, which is his extraordinary cynicism, which I think continues to play well to people today, and a dark side that is half concealed in the films. Mm-hmm. So it's not all just fun and games. You really feel that there's something at stake.
Yeah. Yeah, so you get a sense.
Is that too long-winded an answer for you, Andy? No,
not at all. That's fantastic. I think you've laid out a lot of the kind of stakes of the book just in that answer.
So where do we go from here?
Where do we go from here? So your book is not a biography, but it might help to just give our audience a brief biographical sketch. You mentioned that he started out as a screenwriter. Could you just give us a sense of who he was, where he came from, and how he became the first writer-director of really great sound films in Hollywood? How did he get to that point?
Sure. He did not begin as a director. He did not begin as a writer. He began as a kind of international bum or would-be international playboy. Sturgis was born around the turn of the 20th century. His mother, Mary Dempsey, was a young Irish woman who had grown up poor in Chicago. She and her family lived on the kindness of an uncle who had a saloon back of the yards. Mary managed to work her way up in the world remarkably, and I'll get to that in a moment. Sturgis's father was a guy named Biden, of all things. He wasn't around for very long. His main attraction seems to have been that he was a charming fellow who played the banjo and drank too much. By the time Sturgis, young Preston, I should say, was about 2 years old, Mary Dempsey she had just about had it. She had took off with him to Paris. She had decided she wanted to be a singer, and she thought she would just study in Paris. When looking for a place to stay, she wound up being referred to the home of a Mrs. Duncan, who was taking in people. Mrs. Duncan was the mother of Isadora Duncan. Before you knew it, Isadora Duncan and Mary Dempsey were best friends. Mary Dempsey changed her name to Marie Desty, sounded better. And Preston spent his early years bouncing around Europe in the wake of his mother and Isadora Duncan. So as he put it, he was dragged through every museum in Europe, went to every opera performance. Of course, he was living in the midst of this wild new atmosphere of experimental dance, in which Isadora Duncan was the priestess and goddess. Sturgis's mother, meanwhile, managed to marry a stockbroker in Chicago, an older man named Solomon Sturgis, who became the adoptive father. Young Preston adored the man. So Preston Sturgis grew up, in his own account, very uncomfortable with the crazy artsiness of his mother's crowd, and very much emotionally tied to his adoptive father, Solomon Sturgis, who was a very solid, manly, business-like guy. This framework of looking at Sturgis's life became very popular when he became a famous filmmaker, because people interpreted the films as being dialogues or conflicts of these two sides of him. Mm-hmm. I would propose that this is way too simplistic a way of looking at it. The point being that he didn't do much with his life for many years, except marry well, hang out on an estate in Connecticut. He was, for many years, his mother's business agent. This is back when he was a teenager in New York City. His mother had a cosmetics business that she had invented, the Maison Desty, and Sturgis was running it for her when he was a teenager, living on his own. But eventually, in the wake of romantic misfortune, he decided he had to do something with his life, and he decided he'd be a playwright. It took him about a year, but in the late 1920s, he had a smash hit on Broadway, a comedy called Strictly Dishonorable. Suddenly he was famous, he was rich, he married an even wealthier heiress than he had married before. He married Eleanor Hutton, who was the daughter of Marjorie Merriweather Post, and her adoptive father was E.F. Hutton, which is how Sturgis wound up being a house guest at Mar-a-Lago when it was the Marjorie Merriweather Post estate. But that marriage didn't last either. The Broadway career nosedived. Eventually, Sturgis found himself, more or less reluctantly, in Hollywood as a screenwriter for hire, and worked his way up in the studio system until in late 1930s, he won the right to direct his own films. He was, as you mentioned, really the first person in the studio system to write and direct films. It used to be that studio movies were written by relay teams of writers. It was highly unusual for a single person to have written an entire script. And Sturgis had already been doing that at the studios. He became very highly regarded and well paid at Paramount. Eventually, he managed to sell one of his scripts for the grand sum of $10 on the condition that he be allowed to direct it. That became his first writer-director credit for The Great McGinty. And that brings us up to when he gets into a string, really an unparalleled string of films written and directed, amazing films, something like 10 within 8 years, at which point he crashed and burned his Hollywood career, more or less as the Broadway career had crashed and burned. We don't need to get into that sad story. But meanwhile, there were the glory years, writing and directing his films. It would not be very significant if he were the first writer-director in Hollywood history if the films weren't very interesting. But the films are amazing. They're the crown jewels of American film comedy. So that, in a few lines, is the biography of Preston Sturgis.
Great. I think one thing that really comes through from that brief biographical sketch is just how wide his experience of humanity was. I mean, he knew everybody from, you know, banjo playing bums to, you know, high society heiresses to Broadway show people. And that really comes through in the movies, that kind of intimate knowledge of people from a wide variety of walks of life.
Absolutely. When he does a high society scene, he does it as somebody who actually lived in high society. When he made The Lady Eve, he lent Paramount his own silver service so that the big dinner party scene in the mansion in Connecticut would be properly furnished. At the same time, he had lived among all sorts of raffish artists. He grew up bilingual. He was bilingual in not quite bilingual, very close to bilingual in French and English. When his mother used to drop him off places because she was tritzing around with Isadora Duncan and always coming back with a different man who had to be introduced to young Preston, there was one point when he was something like 4 or 5 years old when his mother left him with a farm family in France. And he was so young that by the time his mother showed up 6 months later, he thought that this farm family was his real family. So that's the way he grew up. Sometimes with, you know, in great luxury, sometimes with all sorts of arty people around him. And I don't think that he was as dismissive of them as he later told newspaper reporters when he was spinning his own legend for them. Because mm-hmm. when you look at the films, they are full of all sorts of high art references, sometimes disguised because it was not considered a proper thing to do back in those days in Hollywood, maybe even in today's Hollywood, to parade your erudition about anything. But if you look at the way the films actually work, he knows a lot about a lot of different things. So yes, he had great knowledge of humanity and was in many ways a much less biased filmmaker than you found in general in Hollywood. I'm thinking in particular of the really unparalleled climax of his film Sullivan's Travels.
Mm-hmm.
It's a scene in a black church service, which is so respectful of the black characters, so sensitive to them, so concerned with their dignity, that the scene almost can't be assimilated into classic Hollywood. There's really almost nothing like it.
And didn't Walter White of the NAACP write a letter to Preston Sturges thanking him for that scene?
Exactly. The executive director of the NAACP thanked him for it. I'm sure that today people can take exception to this or that aspect of it. And I don't want to exaggerate Sturges as some kind of progressive, because he certainly was not. If anything, he was a rock-ribbed conservative politically.
Mm-hmm.
But he really did not seem to accord at all with the general American, white American bigotry against black people. He seemed to regard it with something of horror. That doesn't mean that he didn't work in menial black characters in his movies and sometimes mock them in ways that really make audiences uncomfortable today and ought to have made them uncomfortable in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the exception to that that makes Sturges so fascinating. And I should point out that even with the menial black characters, he gives them terrific lines too. They have to have brilliant dialogue, because just because they're black servants or Pullman porters doesn't mean they can't say clever things.
And they often seem more insightful about their kind of upper class, employers or clients or customers than those people themselves. They often have that kind of subaltern wit about them, right? That they see things that other characters don't.
Absolutely. I'm thinking of Charles R. Moore in the role of the Pullman porter in the Palm Beach Story.
Mm-hmm.
When the husband comes looking for his absconded wife, who has been on a train with the richest man in the world, as it happens, on their way to Palm Beach. And when the husband asked whether his wife had gotten off the train alone, the Pullman porter says, "He give me 10 cents for New York to Jacksonville. She's alone, all right. She just doesn't know it yet."
Pretty great line.
Yes, exactly. It's a pretty great line. Or when Ellen Drew is the love interest in Christmas in July toward the end of the film, asks a janitor, whether a black janitor, whether it's having a black cat cross your path is a sign of bad luck. And the man just says, "That all depends on what happens later."
Pretty good stuff. It almost reminds me of Shakespeare in a way that, you know, I don't think Shakespeare was any kind of a feminist or anything like that, but yeah. Just his desire to make all of his characters seem well-rounded and lived in makes those interpretations of his plays feel somewhat credible. Like, he has these strong female characters. He has, you know, in Merchant of Venice, Shylock is obviously a villain, but is a well-rounded, well-motivated villain. Do you feel like something similar is going on in Sturges, that, you know, despite his somewhat noxious politics from my point of view, his best urges as an artist kind of save him from falling into those traps of stereotype, less for ethical reasons and more just for reasons of craft?
Yes, I agree with you completely. I think you've got it exactly. There are two levels to this, one of which is that Shakespeare was what we would call a whole language writer. He didn't isolate a particular diction for his plays. He was writing with the whole language available to him, high diction, low diction, everything in between. Same with Sturgis. He took delight in every level of language. And in the same way, he took delight in giving every one of his characters something interesting to say. There was definitely a democratic impulse of sorts in the way he just made everybody funny, everybody clever. Mm-hmm. And that even extended to the characters who didn't have anything to say. Some of Sturgis's best gags come from characters who talk and talk and talk without really saying anything. Mm-hmm. And they don't realize that they're not saying anything, but they're hilarious while not saying it.
One of the things you've talked a lot about Sturgis's dialogue, which is obviously, you know, one of his finest qualities. But one thing that always strikes me about the films is how much kind of silly slapstick comedy there is in the films. Like, he's sort of half Oscar Wilde, half Charlie Chaplin. Did he enjoy both styles of comedy equally, do you think? Or did he feel like he kind of had to throw in the slapstick because that was the style of the day?
The slapstick that he did actually was not the style of the day. He revived some of that. Mm. The most notable way he revived that was when he made the film The Sin of Harold Diddlebach, where he got Harold Lloyd out of retirement to play the lead character and based the lead character on Harold Lloyd's 1920s silent comedy, The Freshman. No, Sturgis loved the slapstick. And you're right, one of the characteristics of his filmmaking is this very odd but very effective marriage of high style, elegance, worldliness, urbanity with knockdown comedy. Mm-hmm. Now, while he enjoyed that, not all of his actors did. In The Lady Eve, you can see that Henry Fonda really doesn't appreciate what he's being made to do. But Henry Fonda was a great actor. Mm-hmm. And so he actually converts his discomfort, in fact, his resentment, into the resentment and discomfort of the character. So Henry Fonda actually makes it work, but it's visible. This is not something that he likes. But, you know, with other actors that he worked with, they were perfectly comfortable doing it. In the Palm Beach story, he had Joel McRae take a tumble down a spiral staircase in a duplex apartment. And not only was Joel McRae willing to do it for Sturgis, but Sturgis felt it was only fair that he should demonstrate to Joel McRae how to do it. So before McRae did it, Sturgis did it.
So there's no effects there. They're just doing what it seems like they're doing.
No. I mean, it's sliding down a spiral staircase on a blanket. Yeah.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Let's talk a little bit about his ensemble. There are a few lead actors that show up a couple of times. You've mentioned Joel McRae from Palm Beach Story, who's also the lead in Sullivan's Travels. But there are also a whole host of secondary characters, character actors, that he returns to again and again. What do you think he was looking for in those actors, and how was he able to kind of use them to put flesh and blood on his scripts?
Great question, Andy. It's one of the most characteristic and delightful aspects of his films. Sturgis went around Paramount collecting actors who, for reasons of physiognomy and personality, were never destined to be stars.
Pronounced Eastern European accents, etc.
Well, the one with the most notable Eastern European accent was Julius Tannen, who then played an arrogant Boston physician in Sturgis's film Triumph Over Pain. Julius Tannen put on the Yiddish accent for him, but yeah, he could do that perfectly. Sturgis collected more than a dozen of these bit players, most of them when they were already considered over the hill. He went for the older ones, and he used them again and again in his films. He saw that even though none of them was destined to be a star, each was capable of contributing something marvelous to a film, that each of them had great things to give. And he saw that together, they were more than a cast. They became a kind of human landscape for him, mm-hmm. or a social landscape, which was as important in the settings of his films as what the production designer gave him. So what when you keep encountering these people over and over again in his films, part of the pleasure of watching his films is that you keep meeting these people over and over. Sometimes they give you the impression that life is just nothing but an endless round of the same old mugs again and again, coming back in different ways. But they really do amount to a human landscape. And there was even a star among them, because the principal member of what became known as his stock company was William Demarest. And though mm-hmm. Demarest was never a star in any sense, Demarest did become a kind of star in Sturgis's films, taking two major roles, one in The Miracle of Morgan's Creek and the other in Hail the Conquering Hero. To the degree that anybody could have done it, Sturgis made William Demarest a star.
And he's great in both films, it should be said.
He's great in everything he did for Sturgis.
It's interesting how some of the actors who form such an important part of his company, you know, afterwards go on to do movies that are, you know, much less distinctive and interesting than what they did for Sturgis. Like Joel McRae just does Westerns for the last like 30 years of his career. You know, I mean, I kind of wonder, like, did they seek out being, or did Sturgis kind of seek them out, or did, were people kind of clamoring to be in his films, or how did that process work?
Sturgis went to Joel McRae at Paramount and said, I'm going to write a role for you. I'm going to write a movie for you. And Joel McRae commented later when asked about that, that he hadn't believed it. That his response was, people write movies for Gary Cooper, not for me.
Yeah.
But in fact, Sturgis wrote Sullivan's Travels and The Palm Beach Story and then Triumph Over Pain, all for Joel McRae. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say that toward the end of his life, Joel McRae played the lead in Sam Peckinpah's Ride the High Country, which is, to me, clearly Joel McRae's greatest role, and he's fantastic in it. But yes, the Sturgis films, except for that, are absolutely the high point of Joel McRae's career.
I want to ask you a little bit about Sullivan's Travels, which I get the sense that you maybe don't think quite as highly of that film as some of the others. But for me, that's the top. I think that's my favorite of his movies. Some people have interpreted it as an allegory or a sort of autobiographical film, you know, kind of about him embracing comedy, embracing slapstick and kind of not trying to be as much of a, you know, capital A artist. But you kind of dispute the autobiographical interpretation. Why is that?
There's definitely an autobiographical interpretation, but I don't think it's necessarily the easier, obvious one. That's the thing. Mm. And I'm very cautious about Sturgis's own statements about that movie, as I'm cautious about his statements about all his movies. Every time he said something about his movies, he said something interesting and worth following up, but not necessarily something true. Mm. So when he talked, he was a slippery guy. The reason this book is called Crooked But Never Common is because his films are crooked. They're not common in any way, but they're all crooked somehow. He was devious. When he talked about Sullivan's Travels, for those listeners who may not know about it, this is a film about a very successful Hollywood director of musicals and comedies who wants to do a social conscience movie, a tragic social conscience movie. and his producers really don't want him to do it, but he sort of has them over a barrel. The only way that they can discourage him is to tell them that he grew up too wealthy and has been too privileged to really know about human misery of the sort that he wants to depict. And therefore, so he can make such a film, he has to go out and learn something about humanity. That's what he learns eventually, is that it's really good for him to make comedies and make people laugh.
The producers are proven pretty much 100% right at the end, right?
Right. But then you have to start getting into the details and the nuances and where this doesn't work. Number one, Sturges said that he had made this film because he wanted to send a message to his fellow comedy directors who had gotten too serious, too self-important, or as he put it in the jargon of the time, too deep dish. He wanted to tell them to stick to their business of making comedies. Now, if that's the purpose of making the film, then he has already completely undercut his message that directors should appeal to the audience and make them laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's saying he's making a film to send a message to maybe half a dozen other Hollywood filmmakers. All right, that doesn't make much sense. When you start thinking about which Hollywood filmmakers he's talking about, you don't have many.
Mm-hmm.
You have Capra, who was name-checked in the film, but Capra's most egregious, self-important political film went into production after Sturges had begun writing Sullivan's Travels. The only other person that you could talk about in these terms who might have applied would be Charlie Chaplin, who had made The Great Dictator. And I don't know that Sturges really wanted to be saying that he needed to teach Charlie Chaplin lessons about anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. He also wanted to see Sedge, when he wrote about this, was to tell these film directors to leave the preaching to the preachers, which is a very odd thing to say when, as we've mentioned, the climax of Sullivan's Travels is a remarkable scene which centers on a sermon given by a black preacher in a Southern church.
Literal preaching in the climactic scene.
Yes, a literal preacher delivers the climax of the film.
Yeah.
And I note that the head of production at Paramount told Sturges, cut the black preacher.
Mm-hmm.
And Sturges disregarded his boss and left him in.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something more going on here than just Sturges justifying his own life as a comedy director.
Mm-hmm.
There's something more to that. And there's certainly something more than belittling directors who make serious social justice films. The film that the character wants to make, the film director John L. Sullivan, played by Joel McRae, he wants to film a novel by a guy named Bechstein. If you turn around Bechstein's name, it's Steinbeck.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anybody who saw Sullivan's Travels when it came out could have ignored that this was exactly the sort of film that John Ford had made when he made The Grapes of Wrath. It was evidently possible to make a film about suffering humanity and win Academy Awards and have success at the box office. I think the point in the movie is that it wasn't possible for John L. Sullivan to do it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So good at musicals and comedies, he would be so bad at directing The Grapes of Wrath.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point, as far as I'm concerned. And it's not that he's giving a defense across the board to making comedies. Actually, if you watch the film and you think about Sturges' own career in the studios, there's this undertone of regret and even embarrassment at all the crap he'd had to do.
Mm-hmm.
We remember Sturges for the wonderful, sparkling comedies that he wrote before he became a director as well. Films like The Good Fairy, which he was directed by William Wyler. Fantastic film. But for every one of those, he was the screenwriter for five other films that were either completely worthless or that never got made at all, mm-hmm. that they were canceled. For example, he was the screenwriter for a Jack Benny vehicle that somehow lost Jack Benny and then was never made. that was his life as a writer in the studios. And I think that some of the discomfort and regret of that actually comes out in Sullivan's Travels and makes it a more affecting film, and also helps to explain how some of these strange plays on genre in Sullivan's Travels, a film that's full of different genres of filmmaking, mm-hmm. how some of these films within the film are really pretty crappy.
Yeah.
You know, they're really not quite defensible. So it's a film that's got brilliant, brilliant stuff in it. And then it's got sections that are kind of like the films that Sturges had to write and really didn't enjoy. And I think that a lot of this film is about his feelings about what if I'd been stuck forever doing that stuff? Mm-hmm. What if I hadn't escaped into being able to write and direct my own material?
Yeah, yeah. So it's actually one of the things that about the movie that always strikes me as paradoxical is that it's on its face, it is a movie endorsing, you know, the kind of lowest common denominator, just going for laughs comedy, but it is itself actually a very sophisticated, kind of multi-voiced satire. And you're sort of suggesting, I guess I'm hearing you right, that we should pay more attention to that subtext of it's actually somewhat the type of movie that it's advocating, rather than that it's advocating a type of movie it itself is not, right?
Right. I wouldn't say that we ought to be doing anything. I try not to give directions to people, but I think that we can enjoy Sullivan's Travels more, appreciate it more, if we do pay attention to the various textures in the film and mm-hmm. the complexities that are underlying it. One scene that I'd like to point out is a fairly early scene where Sullivan is carrying out an imposture with a young woman that he's picked up at a diner, or she thinks she's picked him up. It's not clear who picked up whom, but Joel McRae is driving around with Veronica Lake. Veronica Lake is an aspiring Hollywood actress. She has been introduced to Joel McRae. He says that he used to do things in Hollywood and he knows people. And she's very eager to ask him about all these people. And she asked him, for example, about Ernst Lubitsch and wants to know about if it would be possible to get an introduction to Ernst Lubitsch. She's full of these questions. She also, when he asks about one of the films that he's made called Hey Hey in the Hayloft, she laughs and laughs and carries on. He's ashamed of this film, Hey, Hey in the Hayloft. She loves it. She talks about it. She talks about her favorite scene in it. The only thing is, she doesn't know the name of the person who directed it. Mm. So she knows Lubitsch. She knows the prince of the Hollywood comedy directors. But this guy, she doesn't know him.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there's a sting there.
Mm-hmm. And that maybe reflects more Sturges' feelings about being a kind of anonymous gun for hire screenwriter than his feelings of being a director who by that point was pretty well known as a named director, right?
Exactly. By the time he made Sullivan's Travels, he was famous.
Mm-hmm.
He was so famous that he could, and this in defense of Sullivan's Travels, it was an almost impossible project because it's not a film with a genre. You know, Hollywood had to be able to tell people what kind of movie are they going to see. Is it a Western? Is it a musical? Is it a comedy? Is it a melodrama? Is it something ripped from today's headlines? Sullivan's Travels is none of those things and all of those things. And to get away with making such a mixed up movie, that was amazing. He was able to do that because he had become famous. But you're right in what you say. I think there's a sting from back in the days when he was just an anonymous writer in the bungalows.
Mm-hmm. One criticism I've read from other writers on Sturges is that even though he made a lot of great films, he never made a single film that it can be sort of considered a perfect film, where every moment works exactly how it's meant to. Do you agree with that, or do you think that he has one or two films that you would put in that category?
He said that the favorite of his own favorite among his films was Hail the Conquering Hero, and his reason for that was he said there was less wrong with it than any of the others. you know, he saw the faults magnified, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I don't think that there are any of his films that are perfect all the way through, but I don't know too many films that I would call perfect all the way through. Mm-hmm. It's a very hard thing to do, to make a perfect movie. It has been done, but it's really hard. I would say that Sturges's films are brilliantly constructed. One of the things I wanted to do in the book was get beyond the sparkle of the dialogue, get under the hood of these movies and look at how they're put together, because the construction is absolutely amazing. He was a master at how to handle screen time. He was a master at making contrasts and making links among things. So there, for most of these films, there's a consistency, there's a coherence. And it's not just structural, it's also thematic. It's thematic and it's characterological, because he thought through all of the characters so carefully and so deeply. He wanted to be sure that every character had his or her reasons and that the audience could understand what those reasons were. And in that sense, I would put him right up there with Jean Renoir, with his statement in Rules of the Game that the terrible thing is that everybody has his reasons. The difference is with Sturges, it's the wonderfully funny thing is that everybody has his reasons.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned a few of his kind of themes that appear in film after film. And I think you do a really great job in the book of demonstrating film by film how Sturges' movies really do have that kind of inner core of meaning, that kind of consistent, you know, worldview that somebody like Andrew Saris so valued in directors of this time. Could you kind of give us some, I know I don't expect you to give us a kind of schematic, you know, philosophy, but what are some of the elements of his kind of inner core of meaning that stay pretty consistent throughout the films?
I think I'll give you one big one. And it was important to me to be able to develop this in writing the book. Because the book consists of an introduction that's not quite an introduction, a conclusion that's not quite a conclusion. And in the middle, there are 10 chapters, one for each of the major films. And, you know, frankly, I was concerned whether people would want to read a chapter on this film, then a chapter on that film, then a chapter on the next film, and so forth. So it was crucial to me that I could find connections among them. And one of the biggest connections that I found, and one of the greatest emotional underpinnings, was this underlying, not just fear, but horror of being stuck in the same thing forever, that you just get stuck in the same thing. Now, you see this in a lot of the structures of the films. A lot of the films are circular in structure. They are flashback films. They return you to where you began. They return the characters to the condition of where they began. There are really explicit expressions of dread about being stuck in the same thing. In Sullivan's Travels, when the director, John L. Sullivan, goes out on the road to try to learn about humanity so that he can direct a great film, Every time he goes out on the road, somehow he winds up being dumped back in Beverly Hills. Mm-hmm. And he complains about it, and he says out loud, it's like there's this underlying law, where you began, that's where you shall remain. Mm-hmm. The honor that he has, what makes him an honorable character, is he wants to escape, but he can't get away. But you find this in other characters as well, in all the films, that they get stuck. One of the reasons that I love The Lady Eve best of all is because it's the film where the characters wind up exactly where they began, and somehow magically they break out at the last moment.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's the only one where that happens. But other than that, it's very typical for them to wind up right back where they started.
Do you see the influence of his mother in that? I mean, she was somebody who was certainly never satisfied with where she started or any of the places along the journey, it seems. It seemed like she kind of had that inner drive to constantly be searching for some new way to make a life. Do you think that in some ways his films are kind of a tribute to that aspect of her?
I think one film in particular, but more generally, Sturgis wrote films with, not all of them, but a number of them, with wonderful parts for women.
Mm-hmm.
Very strong women who really take things on themselves. There's the character of the first the secretary, then the wife in The Great McGinty. There is Eve / Jean in The Lady Eve. And then there's especially Geraldine in The Palm Beach Story.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to be an adventuress and goes out to do it. She goes to Palm Beach to divorce her stolid, no-fun husband and make a life and a career for herself before it's too late. And I really feel this film is a tribute to his mother, who, as you say, is somebody who just went running for her freedom and running for her happiness. And toward the end of her life, she even spoke to Sturgis about that when she was dying. She said that she knew it had been hard for him when he was a kid, but she hoped that he understood. She was just trying to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what the character of Geraldine, played by Claudette Colbert, is doing in The Palm Beach Story. She's just running for her happiness.
And in that way, I think this is maybe a departure from a lot of films and novels of that day, where this idea of, you know, the American dream of setting out and making a life for yourself in your own image was really coming under a lot of criticism. But he seems to think, you know, actually, that's a pretty good idea.
Well,
you know, by hook or by crook, right?
I don't think that it's an exclusively American idea. I have
to say that.
I think that there's been a lot of writing about Sturgis that talks about the American lust for success being his great theme. Certainly, people in his films are running for success, but people in other cultures do that too. He loved characters who wanted to make something of themselves, but he also loved characters who just found themselves without any justification, having great streaks of luck. One of the last films that he did just as a screenwriter, the film was directed by Marshall Neilan, was Easy Living, which is a film about a young secretary played by Jean Arthur, who's just taking the bus on her way to work one day, a double-decker bus. So she's on the upper level in the open air, and a very, very, very valuable sable coat just falls on her from the sky. Literally, just fortune falling from the sky. It turns out that a very rich man in the penthouse apartment above has had a dispute with his wife, and in anger, he's thrown her sable coat over the parapet, so it lands on the young woman. But Sturgis has any number of films where good luck, fortune just arrives by chance, mm-hmm. and people deal with it. And it's not because of any great virtue on their part. So is he endorsing the idea that you work hard and get ahead and succeed? Not really. Mm-hmm. He's endorsing the idea that people want to get ahead and succeed, but you could be like the character of Jimmy in Christmas in July, who spends all his time entering contests, thinking mm-hmm. that he's going to make a fortune by entering contests. And he thinks he's won one of these contests when he comes up with a slogan for a coffee company. But his slogan is completely incomprehensible, or almost incomprehensible. Yeah. The trouble with the slogan is it keeps teasing you what almost makes sense.
Yeah.
And he's tricked into thinking he's actually won the contest.
And it's premised on the idea that caffeine doesn't actually keep you up at night, right? That's part of the assumption of the, yeah.
The slogan, which becomes an earworm by the third or fourth time you've heard it, is if you can't sleep at night, it's not the coffee, it's the bunk.
You can see it in life. In
so many different ways, and it's also mangled in so many different ways in the film. It's his great brainwave. But as his girlfriend says late in the film, trying to justify him, he thinks he has ideas.
Yeah. So it's maybe not this sort of Horatio Alger story, though it should be said, he does actually win the contest, you know, terrible slogan and all.
A terrible slogan and all, but it's the dumbest character in the film who hands him the victory. So what are you going to do?
Yes. Yeah, sure. Great. Well, Stuart, thank you so much for talking with me about your book. I really learned a lot about Preston Sturges, and I feel like you've given me kind of new goggles to look at the films with. So thank you so much for that. And I hope people run out and get the book, and I hope it leads them back to some of the most delightful films in Hollywood history.
Thank you so much, Andy. I really appreciate it.